Aloha Friday, everyone. This is Catherine Cruz. You're tuned to The Conversation on this, the 3rd of January. We hear from key lawmakers in the state Senate about what more can be done to deal with illegal fireworks following the mass casualties that we saw here on Oahu. And we hear from a resident in the Aliamanu neighborhood about the aftermath of the blast. And standoff in South Korea. We check in with the Pacific Forum, a foreign policy institute, about the uncertain political times as we begin this new year. Plus, the Big Island's Pacific Tsunami Museum is treading water as it deals with an aging facility and uncertain future. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The medical examiner's office has released the names of two of the victims of the fireworks blast on New Year's Eve, Nellie Ibarra, age 58, and Jennifer Van, who was 23. The governor's office says it has helped to arrange a medevac flight to send 6 burn victims from the New Year's mass casualty events. The military plane is to take off tomorrow for Arizona. Hawaii's only burn unit at Straw Benioff Medical Center cannot handle all of the casualties from the fatal fireworks accident that killed 3 women. We talked to state lawmakers about Governor Josh Green's thoughts about increasing penalties to deter the use of illegal aerials. Here's what the governor said at a news conference on New Year's Day.
It's very likely we will be proposing penalties that will be Class C felonies for anything over 50 pounds of fireworks. We'll debate that at the legislature. We've already heard from legislators just in this first 12 hours. But right now, people are taking terrible risks with other family members and the community. Soon, you'll probably be taking a risk with your own freedom. I don't think anybody should want to go to jail for 5 years or pay tens of thousands of dollars of fines. Love your family, avoid this. Let us put on firework displays in the community. Let us spend the monies to have something special for our citizens, which is what we've been proposing. No more fireworks shows on back streets across our state. I know that this is a deep and important cultural tradition to many people to have some celebration with minor fireworks on New Year's and 4th of July. But it's taking the lives of young people. I think that there is very likely going to be one or two children under age 10 that will either be forever disfigured or dead in the coming hours. Leave that to Queen Straub and Jim to talk about. That could have been any of our grandchildren, could have been any of our children.
You know, when we talked to two veteran lawmakers in the Senate yesterday, Senator Glenn Wakai represents Aliamanu and sits on the Senate Public Safety Committee. We heard yesterday morning from his counterpart in the House, Representative Della Albalati. But here's Wakai.
It was a terrible tragedy. What an awful way to end 24 and be the last thing to happen for 4 people, unfortunately, for 2025. But it really goes to how, from a government standpoint, we really need to do better in safeguarding our neighbors.
What do you want to say about this incident? Because it is your district and, you know, you're on the Public Safety Committee and the governor is talking about tougher penalties. But, yeah, from where you sit, how do we deal with this?
I think we have to change the mindset of the community that, you know, this longstanding view of fireworks being entertainment has to come to an end. I mean, they talk about tradition. I mean, the tradition I'm aware of was just your red firecrackers that made a lot of noise, not anything that shot up into the air. But over time, those who, you know, sell aerials, I mean, it's really based on greed of having to stretch that notion of tradition so that they can sell their illicit goods. And in terms of what to do next, I really don't think we need any more laws. We have great laws on the books. We have terrible enforcement. And when I talked to Jordan Lowe yesterday, he said that he needs more personnel dedicated to go and, you know, sniff out the inventory coming in from the airports or harbors and then going after the bad actors who are setting these things off. As you know, we only set up the Department of Law Enforcement in January of last year. And they've done, a pretty darn good job in confiscating stuff that would be coming in to our communities, but have done a terrible job in prosecuting anybody who has brought that contraband in. So I'm not a big fan of increasing penalties or making more laws. I'm a big fan of funding DLE properly and giving them the tools and resources to go after all the bad actors in our community.
Do you support an all-out ban?
I would support a ban on everything that's not permitted. I mean, I think we like to see the, you know, the Pan Pacific Festival when they have the fireworks display. So I don't want to ban all fireworks, but all residential use of fireworks or non-permitted, non-professional fireworks, I think that needs to come to an end.
Well, I was just told that I think it was Kahala Resort did an event with drones. You know, there's all kinds of things that you can do to light up the sky that don't require explosives. But, you know, I don't know. I don't know if the public's appetite is not in that direction.
Yeah. On a side note, I mean, I'm a big fan of launching drones and I've been working with DLIR, but the state doesn't even know how to license takeoff of drones from any of its properties. So, yes, we should be going down the route of lighting up the sky with drones, but the state, even in that regard, is totally inept at being able to figure out how to move that idea forward.
And so if there's anything that we can do this session to deal with this problem, you know, of the illegals?
I just say we need to put the right personnel and fund DLE properly. Let them do their job. I mean, they've shown us that they can do a good job by taking, 200,000 pounds of fireworks off the street. They just need more personnel to be able to investigate as well as prosecute those scoundrels.
The Emergency Services Department of the city, Dr. Jim Ireland, had mentioned that, you know, one of the problems that they had in responding to this mass casualty event was that the roads were clogged and they couldn't get the ambulances down. You know, they were like staged, I think, a couple of houses away. And then they had to close down Salt Lake Boulevard to set up a triage area. I mean, that's pretty disconcerting.
Well, that area of Aliomanu is always like that. I mean, you have multifamily dwellings there. You know, when you have the city bus can't even get through that on a regular basis. So we have a problem with too many people living on a few streets in that neighborhood.
That was Senator Glenn Wakai, who's with the Senate Public Safety Committee and whose district includes the Aliomanu Salt Lake area. You know, we also checked in with another key lawmaker. Senator Carl Rhodes is the chair of the Judiciary Committee. He largely agreed with Wakai that more laws may not be the answer.
I think where it might actually be helpful to raise the penalty is on the importation side. Maybe make that a Class B felony, which is a max of 10 years in jail. But the real issue is getting the rule of thumb in criminal law is that if you don't think you're going to get caught, it doesn't matter what the penalty is. You can have the death penalty and people will still do it if they don't think they're going to get caught. That's why you can buy drugs in countries where the penalty for having drugs or using drugs is death. They just don't think they're going to get caught. So they do it anyway.
Well, so in this particular case, the tougher penalties would already be in place.
Yes, for 25 pounds or more, it's already a felony.
Well, how do you see getting our hands around this problem?
Well, I think, unfortunately, it has become quite similar to the illegal drug problem. There's an awful lot of people who want to buy illegal fireworks, and as a result, that makes it very difficult. I think there are things that we could do. There's been a number of bills introduced in the last few years because it's, you know, this is a whole new level of tragedy in terms of the consequences, but it's something that many of our constituents have been complaining to us about for years. For example, the bill I put in a couple of years ago was to have more inspections at the port and have a way to pull the suspect containers off to the side so that they don't impede the flow of goods into the state that we all depend on to eat and buy stuff from. And Donovan Dela Cruz has put in money, over $1 million, for a law enforcement task force, different agencies to cooperate to investigate just fireworks. And they've been successful. I think it was 23, they confiscated 20 tons of illegal fireworks. But as you can see from two nights ago, it's 20 tons, but there's a lot more than that coming in any given year.
I don't know. Is there anything you can share with us just about, you know, maybe the opposition to some of the attempts to deal with this?
Well, like a lot of things, it's largely about money. And it's, you know, how high a priority is it? Well, I think it's been high enough priority that we have passed several bills in the last few years, in addition to putting in, as I mentioned, over $1 million for specifically for fireworks and illegal fireworks investigations. But that's it. You know, you need resources to fight. You need personnel, and you need money. I have to think that this tragedy will encourage people at all levels of government to take the issue more seriously.
It is disconcerting because, you know, even after the news broke about these fatalities, we're still hearing the fireworks go off, you know, and it's already days past the New Year's Eve.
Yeah, well, that's what the governor said, that that as the ambulances were pulling up to where the bomb, you know, where the explosion took place, which is quite reminiscent of a Russian attack on a Ukrainian town, you know, indiscriminate killing, that four houses away, people were still firing off aerials. So I think it probably comes back to this whole notion that somehow people just believe it's never going to happen to them. So they keep doing it.
Tragically, there were just so many cases where people's fingers were blown off. And, you know, and the governor was pretty graphic about, you know, brain matter strewn about the neighborhood. Fireworks, you know, blew their brains out, which was very sad.
Well, the kids are the ones that I feel the worst for. I mean, they're in no way culpable for anything. And my understanding is that some of them are maimed probably for life. And that's hard to take.
Yeah. Anything else that you're looking toward, you know, as we get the session underway here, you know, as far as judiciary and what other rules or laws we can get on the books?
As I mentioned before, there have been several bills that have passed recently. It has long been illegal. I think for decades, is my understanding, that it's been a felony for the large amounts that we're dealing with in this instance. And you got to catch them. And people don't respond to raising the penalties unless they think they're going to get caught.
Is there any law we can change or can create to make it easier to prosecute?
We have. We had a bill in 2019, Act 248, that pinned liability on the homeowner. So a homeowner, renter, or other person otherwise responsible for the real property who allows somebody to use their property for fireworks can be liable as well. And we also made it real clear that you could use evidence gathered by neighbors, videos, things like that. You could do that before, but we made it explicit that you can use somebody, you know, an external neighbor's video. We have done it. I mean, it's on the books, as I recall. And so, yeah, I mean, there's still stuff to be done, but most of it needs to be done on the enforcement side.
That was State Senator Carl Rhodes, who heads the State Judiciary Committee, and who said it appears in this case that the Class C felony penalties would apply. We expect the budget briefings later this month for the Department of Law Enforcement will be of high public interest. The residents in the Salt Lake Liamano neighborhood where the deadly explosion took place are still reeling from the events of this week. The blasts left 3 people dead and over 20 injured, and officials say it started when what was described as a cake made of aerial fireworks tipped over and shot into a garage where other boxes of fireworks were stored. Angelina Bagaforo was in her house directly across the street. HBR's Cassie Ordonio went to the area yesterday and spoke with Bagaforo, who described seeing children's toys and a baby bottle strewn on the ground just after the blast.
So we were in the living room of the house directly across the street from the incident. And initially, it was about 11:57 when we started hearing a lot of the explosions. And we thought, you know, I initially just thought it's the grand finale. But it got really loud, really fast, and really bright. And I immediately knew there was something wrong. We had the kids in the house, so we kind of, first instinct was to just get them as far away from as possible from what was happening. So we grabbed them and ran to the back of the house. So for the majority of the incident, we were kind of honkering down in the back side of the home. But Gabe, he was in the driveway when it happened because they wanted to see the fireworks firsthand. And Zach was on the lanai up directly across from it. So I mean, once we started realizing this isn't a controlled situation anymore, I think everyone just kind of took cover and just tried their best to stay as safe as possible until it ended. But the aftermath was terrible. There's just glass everywhere, drop ceilings, debris, people all over the place just trying to figure out and get their bearings. Triaging people, helping the EMTs figure out who needs to go to the ambulances first. It was very chaotic. After we had assessed the situation to be clear out here in regards to the explosion, my buddies came in and all I heard was, there's people. And I was thinking initially that people were trying to get into the house to like seek shelter. So I came running out from the back and they started running out of the house. And I realized then the magnitude of what had happened. I was stepping on glass, our windows got busted in, doors got blown in off the door jams, cabinets fell overwards. I came out and there were just people all over the street. Some were non-ambulatory, some were semi-coherent. Everyone that could walk was just kind of herded off to the triage center. Anyone who was non-ambulatory, we were trying to flag down EMTs, and they did an amazing job. The first responders, they were so quick to respond. They came and they immediately started triaging. They immediately started pulling people who were non-ambulatory and in critical condition to the ambulances and getting them to where they needed to be. I don't think I could have, especially with the circumstances, and especially you can see how crowded the street is and how many people were there. I couldn't have expected a better response from the first responders.
How are you feeling now? Are you still kind of process everything? And what are you and your friends and family doing now with your home situation?
I think that the feelings kind of ebb and flow. It's more so kind of we're in what's the next step mode. But I will say every time I have a little bit of downtime, I think about the situation and what had happened. And it's not the structural damage or the vehicle damage, it's the families that lost their friends and their loved ones, their families that are still praying over the ones that are in the hospital. Like, that's kind of what really hits hard. It's the families that may not be here on island, who may have been, you know, celebrating somewhere else, that are getting these phone calls about what had happened. So that kind of is what really gets me every once in a while. But for the most part, we're getting there. We're all here for each other. We have gotten and received a lot of resources. The Red Cross came and gave us some resources. We get resources from our work as well. So people have been calling and checking in on us. So it's been nice to get that community support. And as far as the living situation, I think we're all used to moving very often. So again, it's just kind of next step, how to move forward.
You said, if you didn't tell me, I wouldn't have noticed. You said that the ceilings collapsed on your lanai?
Yeah, so if you look up there, so the lanai got, in the initial explosion, the actual sliding door, the glass sliding door flew off, as well as the screen door. The drop ceilings up in the lanai came down. The drop ceiling above the front door came off. There's a window up there that got blown in. All of the glass panels got blown in on the left side of the house. All of those glass panels got blown in. Some of the tiles in our bathroom fell off. Our cabinets got rocked. All of the glass bottles that we had on shelving kind of just fell and cracked all over the floor. So it was just a lot.
Did you know the neighbors across the street?
Not very well, but I will say they were very friendly. Like, you know, we came down, we asked for sparklers for the kids. They came over and they were like, they were more than happy to provide any sort of hospitality towards us. So I was born and raised on Guam. We're here temporarily for work. So, I mean, we've been here for a while. We've been here for 3 years now. So it's not lost on us that fireworks and New Year celebrations are a big thing here. Coming from a small island like Guam, I've always been kind of weary of fireworks. I'm not that type of person. So I like to enjoy them. I'm not necessarily the type of person that likes to fire them off. But I do think that, I mean, It's a fun event to have in a controlled environment with people who are experienced, if that makes sense. And again, like I said earlier, this is something that they do every year. So we went into it not thinking anything was going to be any different from any other year.
I read in the late 1980s, early 1990s, that was when the big aerials that we see became kind of part of like Hawaii's culture. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, what is your advice to people who want to celebrate New Year's Eve or New Year's safely?
So I personally think, I mean, obviously environmentals come into play, and with Hawaii, that's not really a big deal because of the fact that it's very consistent, the weather's very consistent. I mean, New Year's, I don't know if you remember, it was rainy that day. It was kind of off for what Hawaii weather's used, what I'm used to Hawaii weather being. So I think making sure that environmentalists play a part in how people fire off their fireworks, and then maybe limiting the size of fireworks that are allowed in residential areas, I think would be, because it would be unfair to say, no, you can't celebrate it. But I think safety does have to come into play, because if you look around, I mean, like, a lot of these are wooden houses, they're so close together, a lot of the parking is street parking, and so I think limiting the size of fireworks allowed to be fired in residential areas, and then if aerials are wanting to be done, maybe have a designated area for families that want to fire aerials.
Do you think the state could be doing more on controlling, like, the illegal fireworks coming in?
I feel like I'm not well-versed or have stayed here long enough to have a, you know, strong enough opinion on that. I think that there could always be better regulations on things, but unfortunately, we don't know what we don't know, right? We didn't know this was going to happen. We didn't know the damage and the lives that were going to be lost that day. So unfortunately, it did happen, and I'm hoping that we can take that and apply it to a learning experience, maybe tailor the law a little bit better. But it's one thing to know what could happen and then see what did happen, if that makes sense, right? So I think hopefully this incident, some brightness comes out of it, in the sense that people actually see the impact that being unsafe with fireworks has. Because you can be told your whole life, fireworks aren't safe, fireworks aren't safe, fireworks aren't safe. But you look at it and it's fun, and everybody's having a good time. So you're not associating the dangers to the action until something like this happens. Mm. And I hate to say, like, use this as a lessons learned, but I thoroughly believe moving forward, you know, people are going to be like, hey, do you remember what happened in Keaka Drive? Like, we don't want another incident like that. You need to be safer. You need to make sure that you're, you know, clearing the area or whatever the case may be.
How has, like, the rest of the community on the street been doing?
I think that, I mean, I talked to the neighbors, not directly across, but right next door, and everybody seems to be doing fine. I think everybody's just kind of in repair mode, because a lot of these houses, you know, at first glance, you don't see a lot of damage, but a lot of it's inside the house. A lot of our windows have been busted open. So everybody's been kind of just in their own space, taking care of what they need to take care of, taking care of the hazards that are within their homes. But I mean, we've all kind of just talked to each other in passing, and everybody has been very supportive. You know, if you need anything, let us know. We're right across the street. And that's nice, especially because prior to this incident, I haven't really talked to anyone on the street. So it's nice to see the community come together in that sense. I did see people come out and offer to help clean up. And, you know, I was sweeping out this driveway and people were like, do you have an extra broom? Can I help you? So that was nice to see. I'm like, wow, I've never even seen you on this road before. So when something like this happens, it is nice to have people to lean on and people to check in on you. So if anyone out there knows people that were near or may have been affected, like, talk to them, make sure they're okay, reach out.
That was Angelina Bagaforo talking with HBR's Cassie Ordonio. Residents are said to be exhausted from the ordeal, and the street still smells of gunpowder. Some homes have shattered windows, broken doors, and collapsed ceilings.
When you're out and about, stay connected on the HPR mobile app. Whether you're on a run, walking the dog, or just doing errands, take Hawaii Public Radio with you. Stream the latest news and talk from HPR 1, or experience the soothing calm of classical music on HPR 2. Plus, you can see playlists, listen to interviews, and see the program schedule too. Available 24/7 right from your smartphone. Available on the App Store or on Google Play.
When was the last time you felt like you could really, truly be yourself?
This is where I belong in this moment, and I love the people I'm with.
What it means to live authentically. It's the kickoff to our new series, Wellness 2.0, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11. Support for HPR comes from Ulupono Initiative. By investing and partnering in local food production, Ulupono supports Hawaii's farmers and ranchers who help reduce the risk of wildfires through land management and stewardship.
South Korea is still in a week of mourning because of a plane crash that killed close to 200 people. Its finance minister is now acting president, dealing with the tragedy. That's because for a second time in 2 weeks, South Korea's parliament voted to impeach its president. Acting President Han Duck-soo was impeached over a dispute around selecting justices that would decide the fate of President Yoon Suk-yeol for declaring martial law last month. An attempt to arrest Soon at his residence had been blocked by his loyalists after a nearly six-hour standoff. Take a listen to some of this footage from the AP and the BBC of supporters outside President Yoon's official residence.
They have to kill me first before they arrest President Yoon. I'm ready to lie down and be killed by the communist elements.
Mr. Yoon swore he'd fight this to the end. And this is exactly what he, his security, and his supporters are now doing.
You know, this morning we checked in with Rob York. He's the regional affairs director at the Pacific Forum, a foreign policy institute. He traveled to Korea three times last year and has been tracking the latest events from the impeachment to the plane crash.
Korea certainly has been in the news more than it would have liked to in the last couple of months for this and because of the tragedy that happened with the flight. Security or safety standards have been a recurring issue there, whether it's the crowd crush incident at the Itaewon Halloween celebration more than a year ago, I think, and the Sewol ferry disaster, of course. So some people say that that is connected to the rapid pace at which the country developed, kind of in disregard, I guess you could say, of safety standards. So that's an issue that rears its head every few years.
All this is playing out against the backdrop of this political upheaval and the martial law action that we saw. So how are you looking at the latest turn of events? Because they were trying to arrest, you know, the president.
Right. Usually the president is not subject to actual criminal proceedings until their removal from office is confirmed. And this effort to prosecute him or to arrest him essentially before the Constitutional Court has ruled on the matter placed the country in somewhat uncharted territory. Park Geun-hye in 2017 was arrested, but not until after her removal from office was confirmed by the Constitutional Court. If the arrest had gone through and by some chance the Constitutional Court had reversed the decision to impeach him, that would have placed the country in a very awkward position. So I think this is probably an issue that will remain unresolved until the court ruling happens. But on the upside, it sounds like the court is committed to ruling on that sooner than later and will not wait the entire 6 months.
Well, and then we have a second impeachment of the interim president, you know, due to the issue about the judges.
That is far harder to justify than the Yoon impeachment. We can definitely say that. It seems to be centered around the appointment of justices that were preferred by the Democratic Party and specifically by their leader, Lee Jae-myung. That is a case of the Democratic Party putting forth nominees that it prefers for the court in order to fill the vacancies that are there. And they would probably argue that the purpose of that is to ensure that the vacancies don't inhibit a ruling or a resolution of the court case. However, there is a certain irony in that Yoon Suk-yeol declared martial law in early December, claiming that obstruction was a threat to national security. And now the Democratic Party is saying that obstruction by the conservatives and their refusal to appoint these justices is a impeachable offense for the acting president. And so it seems like obstruction, which is honestly an issue for most mature democracies, especially in recent times, has been treated by Korean politicians as an opportunity to ram through decisions that they consider beneficial for them at a given time. Not to mention the fact that they impeached him with a majority vote rather than a two-thirds vote, which is something that I think is going to be constitutionally questionable. They did so claiming that he is a cabinet member. He of course, was prime minister before he ascended to the role of acting president, and so that's the basis under which they impeached him by a simple majority vote. And so there's going to be a lot of grounds to challenge that ruling, that action.
And then we have a third acting president who, you know, obviously then is focused on dealing with the plane crash and that probe as well. But, you know, what do we know about him and what happens next?
Well, he's the finance minister, so investors can probably look to that and say, well, at least there's going to be somebody who has his eye on the nation's, you know, finances who is running things. And this is something that people will have reason to be concerned about, given the effect that the recent events have had on the currency and on Korean stocks as well. So what we know about him is that he's been dealt a very difficult hand and that the threat of impeachment probably looms over him as well, especially if the constitutional court nominees that the Democratic Party wants are nominees that they are determined to see happen at this stage. And if they refuse to go with the previous acting president's call for some sort of bipartisan agreement on them.
Just, you know, stepping back, it's like a soap opera. I mean, it's just crazy, but, you know, it's very serious just because security in the Pacific region is shaky right now.
Yeah, and South Korea, because it has its northern neighbor that, you know, refuses to recognize its right to exist, has had some relatively stringent laws on national security really since the early days of its independence. And this has been used at different times in order to pass laws that I think, you know, observers from North America or Europe might consider to be extreme. It's been about 10 years now since the government ordered the disbandment of a minor progressive party, and that decision was upheld by the Constitutional Court as well, basically on national security grounds. And this is something that is applied somewhat inconsistently, kind of depending on who's in charge, but conservative administrations have tended to apply it more stringently. That security dynamic is something that Yoon Suk-yeol cited in his martial law declaration as well. And so there certainly is a broader security picture in the region that needs to be considered, and recent developments there are not the best in terms of overall confidence about Korea's role in maintaining a positive security environment.
And I don't mean to put you on the spot, but now the Pacific Forum is hosting a conference in February to talk about security in the region.
Yes. And we will be focusing heavily on defense integration. So there will be a lot of focus on how the countries, how the armed services in the region can work together in fostering a more secure environment. And so I would encourage listeners to check out our page on the Honolulu Defense Forum to see the topics that will be covered there, as well as our speakers and guests.
Anything else you want to say just about all this drama that we're watching play out?
So South Korea's government, South Korea's democracy will get through this in all likelihood. It's going to be a bitter experience for some people, especially those of us who have really promoted closer Korean and U.S. integration on these issues, because for a while to come, there will probably be less of that. And so there's going to be more of a focus under a new Korean administration, the way things are going, on probably Korea acting more independently. That can also present opportunities of its own, but there certainly will be challenges in the years to come.
Oh, and one thing I did want to address for our listeners is, you know, I know in some of the stories there have been calls for the death penalty for President Yoon. You think that's likely to happen?
People will say things like that. People will certainly say he deserves death for this action, for betraying the country, things like that. But it's not very likely, no. In fact, you know, Chun Doo-hwan was the dictator of the country who suppressed the Gwangju uprising in 1980. And he would eventually, years later, face, you know, the death penalty. He was sentenced to death over his involvement in that uprising. That was ultimately commuted, however, and that has been the tendency for Korean presidents who have faced legal repercussions for their actions as president. Many of them have been prosecuted later on, and those sentences are, generally speaking, usually pardoned or commuted later on. So Yoon Suk-yeol, I would say, is unlikely to face the death penalty for his actions. In fact, he's unlikely to serve a full prison term.
Okay, and I guess the first step is an arrest, and he hasn't been arrested yet, right? And hence the standoff. So yeah,
right.
we'll see how this plays out. But thank you so much, Rob. I appreciate it.
Of course.
Like I said, trying to make sense of all this. I appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you.
That was Rob York with the Pacific Forum talking with us about the latest developments in South Korea. Opposition forces have been trying to arrest, impeach President Yoon Suk-yeol, but have been blocked by his loyalists.
HPR Generation Listen invites you to Trivia Night every first Monday of the month at Village Bottle Shop and Tasting Room in Kaka'ako. It's an opportunity to connect with fellow public radio nerds in an evening of lively but friendly competition. Gen Listen connects younger listeners and young at heart listeners with the station and with each other. Connect with us in person at HPR Gen Listen Trivia. Sign up to play at hawaiipublicradio.org/genlisten.
When you support HPR, you support classical music and all its benefits.
Melvin Yee, neurologist here in Honolulu, longtime HPR member. Your love for guitar that you're sharing for us tonight on our evening concert.
What I always tell my patients who are worried about their cognitive ability as they age, that one should always try to keep your mind active.
There are many studies about the health benefits of music on your health and well-being.
Yes, it's very peaceful and calming. And then when I play the guitar, I can just focus on that, forget all the other concerns, and just work on playing the music.
Support classical music on HPR. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute for ages 50 and older, with courses designed to engage the mind and enrich lives. Zoom Open House Sunday, January 5th. More by searching OLLIUHM.
It's not uncommon for nonprofits to make a pitch for end-of-the-year giving, but one group in particular caught my eye, the Pacific Tsunami Museum. Here to talk about that is HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so it was sounding like it's kind of dire straits for this organization.
Yeah, so the Pacific Tsunami Museum is temporarily shuttered, and it has been a fixture along Hilo's historic bayfront for over 25 years. But in the last couple of years, it's been facing serious financial troubles. And so now the future of the museum is kind of this open question.
So what's the main challenge?
So I spoke with the museum's executive director, Cindy Preller, and she says that like a lot of small businesses and nonprofits, the museum just never really recovered from COVID. They were open and closed intermittently, and so that affected attendance. People were confused about when they could come and visit. And the museum itself is housed in this nearly 100-year-old building that was once a bank. And if you've seen it, it's this kind of large, imposing stone structure right on the waterfront in Hilo Bay. I found it actually kind of scary when I would visit Hilo as a kid, but it's a cool building designed by local architect Charles W. Dickey. But because it's so old, it needs millions of dollars in repairs, according to Preller. Their HVAC system has gone out, so that's causing problems with mold, and the roof needs to be fixed. So together, the kind of drop in attendance and what needs to happen to the building is really putting them in this current position.
And they own this building?
Yes, this building was a donation actually to the museum by First Hawaiian Bank in the 90s, and they've been there since 1998.
So what's this next step?
So the museum has a lot of different types of offerings that focus on science and history of tsunamis, but really at the core of its collection is its archive of oral histories of tsunami survivors. And the whole museum was actually really born out of this effort to collect and preserve the stories of survivors of the 1946 tsunami, which killed 96 people in Hilo and really reshaped that community. And that effort was led by Jeannie Johnston, who survived that tsunami when she was only 6 years old. And over the last 4 decades, really, she says she's done close to 450 interviews with survivors of the 1946 tsunami, the 1960 tsunami in Hilo, which killed 61 people, and other tsunamis across the world.
I don't think people have any idea of how extensive the archives are. And there's so much knowledge that I've heard. I was thinking about it the other day, that things that I heard that people say, for instance, I was just telling my brother last night about this. I did an interview of siblings. I think there were 4 siblings. The family was together, except for the father, who had gone off to work. And they were the mother, a baby, and a couple of kids, various ages. And it was a 2-story wooden building. It was like a little strip where the people had a business downstairs and they lived upstairs. And when the wave came, the kids were looking out the window and the wave came right through the window and took the whole building back and the roof fell down on top of them. They were all interviewed separately. And the recollections were different. And it was a lot of tactile stuff, or sensory. Some remembered the colors, some remembered the sounds, some remembered what it felt like. But it was very interesting. It was like a tapestry. And if you put all their interviews together, it was amazing.
Yeah, those stories are so powerful.
Yeah, and together they paint this kind of bigger picture of what happens during these kinds of disasters. And Preller made a good point when we were discussing the Oral History Archive. Her background is actually in science. And she says that those interviews contain key observational data.
As a tsunami scientist trying to figure out how to educate people on the impacts of tsunami, before 2004, we really didn't have the digital footage that we do now. The only way that we actually understand the impacts of a tsunami is from the survivors that actually saw it and felt it and smelled it. And our mission really is to save lives through education. So the survivor stories are teaching us exactly what is happening at the time. I mean, we can't set up instrumentation to measure what's going on during the event because it all gets destroyed. You know, the only way we can learn is through the power of story.
Right, the power of observation. Interesting.
Yeah, so at the top of Preller's list in this transition is making sure that that archive is preserved. And fortunately, the museum has a memorandum of understanding with Tohoku University in Japan to financially support this big archiving effort of the museum's collection using the archiving lab at UH West Oahu. But Preller says she needs an archivist, someone who has the expertise to really comb through all of those oral histories, as well as newspaper articles and old photographs that people have donated that make up the museum's collection.
Yeah, you know, I've heard about this this need for archivists, and I believe the Uluulu, the Digital Moving Pictures, you know, they've got classes that they're offering, I think, through Creative Media. We'll be talking more with them next week about this. But yeah, there is a growing demand.
Yeah, Preller seems excited about the resources that are available, and it's just kind of all about putting them together in the right way to make sure that the museum has a sustainable future. And she says a big part of that is investors. So the museum has received a $100,000 grant from the Olson Foundation, but Preller says that's going to need to be matched really several times over to get the museum back on track, especially considering the repairs that need to be made to the building that they're in, which they want to stay in. That building is right on the bayfront, and it has a history with tsunamis itself. It survived both the 1946 tsunami and the 1960 tsunami in Hilo.
Yeah, a big ask, but something worth saving.
Yeah, and I will say that when I spoke to both Preller and Johnston, even though this is a moment of great uncertainty for the museum, they were really optimistic about its future. They both want the museum to continue both as a living memorial, that was something that came up when we were speaking, but also as a key part of the county and state's disaster awareness strategy. Johnston wants visitors to walk out of the museum really thinking about what they would do if a tsunami was approaching. And she even has an idea to turn the old bank vault in the museum into a kind of virtual reality cube.
I would like to have somebody that would like to have a bank vault named after them, a bank vault slash theater named after them, with a ton of money to come and put together an interactive tsunami experience that we could charge people to go to. So my thought is, you have some chairs. Now let's just say there are two chairs in there. You have you're a surround sound and surround video, and you're sitting at the cafe down on Hilo in the not on the waterfront, but it's close across from the water, and so you're sitting in this chair, and there's a little spray maybe of salt water smell so that you get that smell. And you have the ability as this goes on to input what you would do. So you see the water drawing out, and there'll be the sound of the water going out, and then what do you do?
Immersive.
Yeah, and terrifying. But that's kind of the point, right? Is to put people in the mindset of you only have a limited amount of time in these types of disasters. What are you going to do when one occurs? So the minds behind the Pacific Tsunami Museum are taking this time to re-envision how the museum may serve the community and how it can be more vibrant and more relevant and more engaged. And they're working on a pretty optimistic timeline. Preller says that she's hopeful the museum can have kind of a grand reopening in its next form by Thanksgiving of this coming year, which will be in time to commemorate the 50th anniversary of a local Halepe tsunami, which was triggered by a 7.7 magnitude earthquake and caused waves over 25 feet. So that's pretty soon. And in the meantime, the museum will stay open on weekends, which Preller says is mainly a push by staff who are now working on a volunteer basis.
I have an incredible troop of docents and volunteers, and they just are refusing to completely shutter. So they are all stepping up and volunteering. I'm just believing in the dream, and we have fantastic support coming in, and we need more of that fantastic support. And we definitely need the community to know that the support that we have received over the last few weeks, months, have just melted. I cry just almost every day with the outpouring of support. It's been so beautiful. And so, but what it's done is it's built the bridge so that we can actually have the energy to be excited about this dream of revitalizing. So, you know, specific steps as part of the planning process. But the fact that we are excited to get into the planning process instead of just closing the doors and giving up on the mission, right? We are not giving up. No way. No way.
Well, kudos to those volunteers keeping that museum open.
Absolutely. And you can also check out the Pacific Tsunami Museum's website. They're open on weekends if you find yourself in the Hilo area. And they're also accepting school groups throughout this period. So they're still a presence in the community for sure.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the story, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been talking to HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, that's a wrap for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, we plan to have more fireworks follow-ups. Caller Talkback Line, leave us your thoughts about the illegal aerials and your experience this past New Year's Eve. What was it like in your neighborhood? Give us a call at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, with help from Tori DeJournay and Savannah Harriman-Pote. Backyard quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Our theme music, courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.